So after realizing that you are living in a condition that you don't wish to continue to live anymore, and you start to change your behavior, you start to change the way you think, you start to change your kind of actions that you start to enact. And at the same time, not only are you focusing on getting out of suffering, but at the same time also you're focusing on the joy of nirvana. So renunciation has two aspects involved with it. It has the mind which turns away from suffering and actively stays away from suffering. And also at the same time, the mind is focusing on the joy of nirvana. And in order for you to achieve the results where the things that you're experiencing, the experiences that you are undergoing, pleasurable, the kinds of activities that you do are called accumulating merit. Okay. The Tibetan word is sunna. Merit is not something that only bodhisattvas do. It's not only something that those who are about to reach nirvana do also. Any kind of action that you do, any kind of activity that you do that results in some sort of a pleasurable experience, that is accumulation of merit. To get any pleasurable result in samsara itself, like someone said before, no, it's not 24 hours a day that you're suffering in samsara. You're experiencing those kinds of sufferings like the bell that the beings in the hells are experiencing. But there are some times where you experience a kind of suffering that we call pleasure. Okay? And until you're able to actually see the pleasures of suffering, I mean, you see that the pleasures of samsara are themselves of the nature of suffering, your renunciation hasn't really reached a point of maturity. And it doesn't mean that you're eating ice cream or you're watching a very nice movie, and at the same, and then all of a sudden you remember, oh man, this is supposed to be samsara, I'm supposed to be suffering, I'm supposed to have renunciation, and then you try to make the experience into a suffering experience. Okay? That's not what renunciation is about. Renunciation, you can have renunciation, and you're at the same time you're enjoying the ice cream. You're enjoying the movie. Renunciation is that part of it has to do with the wisdom that you understand that the pleasure that you're experiencing is not coming from the actual object that is associated with. It's not the ice cream that's giving you pleasure. It's not the movie that's really giving you the pleasure. So you're not attached to the movie, you're not attached to the ice cream. Okay. But you enjoy the ice cream, you enjoy the movie, you enjoy the cup of tea. Okay. And you can even consider that whatever pleasure that you experience, if you can get any kind of experiences of pleasure, any kinds of pleasant experiences while you're in samsara, grab it and make the best use of it, okay? Samsara doesn't give you much, okay? So just to have a nice cup of ice cream and enjoy it, to have a good rebirth, that requires the accumulation of merit of some kind. So merit is not something that is necessarily leads to the achievement of nirvana, or Buddhahood. And for those of you who are hearing these two terms for the first time, maybe you've heard it before, there might be some confusion about the nirvana and Buddhahood. Buddhahood is a kind of nirvana, but when you hear the word nirvana by itself, it's usually referred to a lower kind of nirvana. What would be a lower kind of nirvana? A lower kind of nirvana is a nirvana where you're not a Buddhahood, you're not a Buddha. So once you've reached the end of all suffering, once you've stopped the mechanism that perpetuates suffering forever, through constant direct impact, constantly, continually impacting your mind with the direct perception of reality, eventually that wears out on the tendency to accumulate the causes of suffering. And once you've done away with the causes of suffering altogether and you don't have the experiences of suffering anymore, then you reach nirvana. And within nirvana itself, there's the what is called the shravaka realization, or the listener's realization, and the pratika realization, which is a solitary Buddha. The difference between the two of them, one is The Pratika Buddha is somewhat higher than the listener Buddha. The difference between the two of them is that different interpretation as to why is a listener called a listener. The listener is called a listener, sometimes they're called a listener because they listen to Mahayana teaching but they don't practice it. Okay. That's one reason that you want to achieve the state of a listener. And also the listener is someone who goes to a teacher, listens to teachings and practices it and achieves nirvana that way. And a Pratika Buddha is called a solitary realizer because in that very life, when they practice, they don't need to go to a teacher to learn anymore. So they've done all the learnings that they've had to do, and now they remember the teachings that they've received before, and they go, they're called rhinoceros disciples. They go to a cave somewhere or to some mountain or to somewhere where they meditate and they achieve nirvana that way. And also it depends on the object that they use mainly as an object of meditation. That also determines whether they achieve nirvana or whether the nirvana of a listener or the nirvana of a Pratika Buddha, a solitary realizer or solitary Buddha. And anyone who achieves nirvana is called a foe destroyer because they have destroyed the foe, which is ignorance. So the Buddha is a kind of an arhat, the Shravaka is a kind of an arhat, and the Pratika Buddha is a kind of an arhat. Arhat is the Sanskrit term for foe destroyer, chomdende, the Tibetan word for that. And it's not really an actual translation of arhat. Okay? Chomdende is actually a kind of a definition translation. One of the definitions of arhat is someone who transcends. And then the Tibetans took the definition and they made that into the translation, how they translate the term arhat. Okay. So, in order for you to achieve any pleasant experience in samsara, you need to accumulate virtue. So that means necessarily you also need to accumulate virtue, again nirvana of the lower scope, or the nirvana of Buddhahood. Now let's get to the Buddha. So you finally realize that the object of your urge all these years, throughout all your life, finally you're able to now label it as nirvana or label it as Buddhahood. Now, what is Buddhahood like? What are the qualities of Buddhahood? What will you be possessing when you are called a Buddha? And the term that we used last day was you become a blissfully omniscient one. Okay. There are two things that you need to engage in order for you to achieve Buddhahood. Okay. One is called tab, which means method, and shira, which is wisdom. Remember that prayer that we recited at the end of the class, the dedication prayer? Gewa di kewo kun sunam yeshe sok zok shing sunam yeshe lejun weda bakun deva. In the English translation of it is, by the power of this virtue, may all beings achieve the accumulation of merit and wisdom. Okay, so merit and wisdom are the two pairs, either method and wisdom or merit and wisdom. Okay. Wisdom has to do with training yourself in correct view. Training yourself in such a way that one day you develop the state of mind that directly interacts or is impacted directly perceiving the true nature of reality. And you have to keep on doing this meditation. And this kind of meditation is called vipassana, klakton, okay? It is a very concentrated state of meditation, or you can call it concentrated analysis. Although your mind is turning, that is analyzing something, but it's doing it in a very focused way. And it's doing it in such a way that it allows the mind to be able to be so free, so pure, that it can directly perceive emptiness. And you have to keep doing this over and over and over again, so that by directly perceiving emptiness, you're actually working on those obstacles which are preventing you from experiencing nirvana. And those kinds of obstacles are called nyundi. The ones that prevent you from experiencing the nirvana of the lower scope. That is the nirvana of a listener or the nirvana of a solitary realizer. That's nyundi. Nyun is for nyun, short for nyunmong, which is the Tibetan for mental affliction, bad thoughts, sometimes translated as that. And deep is obstacles. So by constantly having your mind being impacted by the true nature of reality, you're wearing on the obstacles that prevent you from experiencing nirvana. And one day, you're able to experience nirvana, and from that moment on, you cannot fall from having that achievement. Okay. There's no such thing as someone who achieved nirvana and then lost it. There's no such a phenomena. It's impossible for it to happen. Because the actual achievement of nirvana, by definition, means you have completely put an end to the causes of suffering. That's why you're able to be said to have achieved nirvana. So that's the shirab part. That's the part where you are training your mind in wisdom. The other part of the path, those are sometimes called the two wings of enlightenment. The method part. The method part, it deals mostly with bodhicitta. That is the activities that you do with your mind influenced by bodhicitta. And they include the 10 perfections, and they include some other things also. But mainly the 10 perfections. And within tap is also renunciation. And sometimes bodhicitta is referred to as a kind of renunciation. Instead of having a renunciation turned towards yourself, the renunciation is turned towards others. It's like you're having renunciation for others. Okay. And by engaging in tap, that helps you to achieve omniscience. That's what helps you to be able to get rid of the kind of obstacles that prevent you from achieving omniscience, which is mentioned yesterday, which is shiddhi, okay? Knowledge obstacles. And only a Buddha is someone who has freed himself or herself from shiddhi. Someone who has merely achieved nirvana hasn't freed himself from shiddhi yet. So, that's why Jason Kapa, it's not in this book. I think it's in the Lam Rim Chenmo, where he praises bodhicitta over wisdom. And he praises bodhicitta in the sense that it's rare among the spiritual beings that only bodhisattvas have it. But you have three kinds of spiritual beings. You have the listeners, the pratika buddhas, and you have the bodhisattvas. And only bodhisattvas have bodhicitta. And because of that, he praises bodhicitta above wisdom. And he says wisdom is, it's a common thing. All spiritual beings who are achieving or on their way to achieve nirvana, either the lower one or the higher one, they possess wisdom. Okay. And also, one of the reasons that His Holiness the Dalai Lama also praises bodhicitta above wisdom. It's not to say that bodhicitta, all you need is bodhicitta. You need both. You need both bodhicitta and you need wisdom. But because bodhicitta is the main factor that actually works to achieve omniscience, the distinctive quality of a Buddha, that's why it's praised above the other one. So among the three principal paths, we have renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view. Renunciation and bodhicitta fall under the method side, and then correct view falls under the wisdom side. And also this is also falls into the kind of results you're going to get once you achieve Buddhahood. Once you achieve Buddhahood, you're still going to have a body, you're still going to have a mind. The kind of mind that you have once you achieve Buddhahood is called Dhammakaya. And the term Dhammakaya, by the way, is not a term that is unique to Mahayanas. The Theravadins have it also, but they have a completely different meaning for it. For them, Dhammakaya simply means the scriptures of the Buddha. But within the Mahayana tradition, the term Dhammakaya has a completely different meaning. It means the omniscient quality of the Buddha. Okay. So when you become a Buddha, you will have a Dhammakaya. And one of the qualities of the Dhammakaya is that every Dhammakaya is the same. The Dhammakaya of every Buddha is completely the same. So no Buddha has a different Dhammakaya than another. But the form body of the Buddha, different Buddhas, are different. That's why you have Tara, Green Tara, White Tara, Manjushri appearing golden with a sword, and then Avalokiteshvara, and you have Maitreya, you have Buddha Shakyamuni, you know, appearing the way he does. That's the form body. And the form body is called the Sukhu, and that's the Nimanakaya in Sanskrit. And when you hear about the Nimanakaya, when you hear about the attributes of the Nimanakaya, in a sense that everything that you always wanted with this body, that's what you're going to achieve with that Nimanakaya. You want this body to be the most beautiful thing that you, when you look at yourself in the mirror, you say, wow, that's the most beautiful person I've ever seen. And it doesn't age, it doesn't experience pain, it doesn't experience disease, and it just continues perpetually. You can sit in meditation, you know, for a few eons and you will not experience pain. And the sutra describes that body in one way, and the tantra describes the body in a different way. Basically, in the tantra, it's the quality of great bliss is incorporated, is listed in there. So it's a body possessing the five certainties. Okay. And the certainties are the certainty of environment, the certainty of enjoyment, the certainty of entourage, the kind of people who will be around you, the certainty of, I'll get to them. So when someone hears about the Dhammakaya, then they become inspired to take on the Bodhisattva path because, you know, they want to achieve that kind of a body. You know, I mean, that's what we want with this kind of body already. Now there's you can actually achieve it. You don't have to go to the spa. You don't have to do 100 push-ups a day. You don't have to do cosmetic surgery, okay? And you don't have to keep going to the doctor to make sure that you keep what you have, okay? Just by nature, it stays where it is. And one of the certainties is the certainty of having the attributes. The attributes we call the... and these things, I'm sure a lot of you, I mean, you probably think that, I don't think I really want that in my Dhammakaya, in my Nimanakaya. You know, the 112 major, 82 and 112 marks of a Buddha. They're supposed to be like marks of beauty. And according to us, you know, some of those marks of beauty, we don't really consider them to be marks of beauty, like having long ears, flat foot, those kinds of things. They're considered to be marks of beauty. I guess if you, at the time of the Buddha, within the Vedic tradition, they had some sort of a tradition of considering like that someone who they call it a superman, okay, like a supermodel or something like that, okay. If for someone to be qualified a supermodel, they must have these kinds of qualities: flat foot, long ears, a bump in the head, and those kinds of other things, okay. But you don't have to worry about that, okay? You're not gonna get stuck with any qualities that you don't want. Okay? When you look at yourself in the mirror, when you have a Nimanakaya, you're gonna say, this is the most beautiful person I've ever seen. Okay? And looking at yourself will give you great pleasure. Okay? And you will not be narcissistic either, okay?
It's a body that can be
seen. Yeah, it's the body that can be seen. The Dhammakaya can only be seen by Buddhas. The Nimanakaya can be seen by ordinary beings. Well, ordinary beings have great virtue to see such things. So, both these terms, the Dhammakaya and the Nimanakaya, can also be sometimes, they're both subcategorized into two different kinds of bodies. Like the Nimanakaya is just, sometimes it's called the Rupakaya, the form body. And that is subcategorized into two other kinds of bodies. One body is the body that sort of is the one that I describe, which is always the one that you keep looking at yourself in the mirror and you say, oh my God, I can't believe how beautiful I am. That kind of body. And it just doesn't age, doesn't experience pain, doesn't get sick. That body is a Sambhogakaya body. It's the body that actually, it's in a world, it's in a perfect world. It's in a, it's kind of a heaven. And that's the body that is called to be in what is called the Buddha field or Buddha land, okay? The Sambhogakaya. And the Sambhogakaya is not achieved because you want to have a beautiful body one day. The Sambhogakaya is achieved as a means to teach bodhisattvas. So bodhisattvas were way advanced on the path, sort of free of having to take rebirth in samsara, but they're not free yet from, they haven't achieved Buddhahood yet. They still need a place to learn, to study. So they go to a Buddha land. That's what the Buddha land is for. The Buddha land is like a, you know, a Buddha university, basically. Everyone who's there, they're learning, they're practicing to become a Buddha. And while they're there, they do, you know, incredible things. They send out emanations. Everybody can do incredible things. And sometimes someone who's lower, a lower being, cannot make a distinction between some of the beings who live there and a Buddha because they seem to be doing the same thing. Mm-hmm.
Is that what happens in monasteries?
In monasteries? You mean sending out emanations?
Yeah.
If anyone is doing that, no one knows about it. Especially within the Gelugpa tradition. Within the Gelugpa tradition, if you have achieved certain abilities to do magical feats, you're not allowed to demonstrate them. If you demonstrate them, you'll be kicked out of the monastery. Of course, that depends on what kind of being you are. You may choose to dispense with that rule, like Nagarjuna did. Nagarjuna was probably the greatest achiever of yogic deeds. I think he achieved the ability to manifest immortality within his own body. And not only was he able to do that, he was able to do other kind of things. Like one day the monastery was starving and then he made food out of, I don't know, he drew a picture of a cow and then and he milked that cow and he gave the monastery milk or something like that. And he made gold out of sand and things like that because the monastery was running out of fun. And guess what they did when they found out he was doing this stuff? They kicked him out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, rule is a rule. Okay? Doesn't matter if the monks are starving, you're not supposed to do miracles to help them. So, as a bodhisattva, Nagarjuna did what he was supposed to do. If he didn't do it, he would have been breaking his bodhisattva vows. And the monastery did what they were supposed to do. Because you're not supposed to be showing miracle powers. And if you do, then they're supposed to kick you out. So everybody did their job. So the body that you achieve in order to teach other sentient beings, specifically bodhisattvas, that body is the Sambhogakaya body. And it has all those incredible attributes to inspire faith in the bodhisattvas. Like when they see the Sambhogakaya, they're not going to have any doubt as to whether or not this being can teach me how to reach Buddhahood. Okay. Just by seeing the Sambhogakaya, they have deep faith. Another kind of body that you will be able to have, that it's not really a body, it's really, you could say, a potential. You will be able to manifest as any kind of form to teach those who are not bodhisattvas. So that kind of form, that's really what is called the Nimanakaya. And that form can appear as anything. It could be a man, it could be a woman, it could be a dog, it could be a cat, it could be an inanimate object. Whatever is necessary to appear to someone so that someone either could be, for that moment, could have some sort of revelation. It could appear as someone who has actually taken birth and who seems to have some sort of a history. They were born on that day, they went to that school, they graduated, they did this practice and that practice, and now they're teaching this and that. It could be this kind of an emanation, or it could be an emanation that appears for just a brief period of time, in whole. Like it could appear as all of a sudden, either you meet someone in the street, and then some because of your interaction with that person or that thing, there's some revelation that happens in your mind. Okay, that's an emanation of the Buddha. Mm. And another kind of emanation of the Buddha could also be a thought in your own mind, or it could also be a sound that you hear. It could also be just a pure activity. And that pure activity could be something that possesses someone. Okay? In a sense of, all of a sudden your stupid friend says something very enlightening. Okay? That could be an emanation, an activity of the Buddha. Okay? Or your stupid friend says something stupid and yet it still is enlightening. Okay? That could also be an emanation of the Buddha. And those are Nimanakayas. Okay? And those fall under the Rupakaya. So under the Rupakaya, you have that form, that body that everybody aspires to in this life, and that makes people have a false aspiration for Buddhahood. Why do you really want to become a Buddha? You just want to become a supermodel. Okay. Well, I want to have a beautiful body that's going to be in heaven, and I'm going to have never going to have any disease, I'm going to be beautiful, I'm going to be blissful. I'm going to have a bunch of bodhisattvas, you know, bowing to me, asking me for answers. Okay. If that's your reason for wanting to achieve Buddhahood, then at best, if you really practice well, you will achieve Pratika Buddhahood. You will not achieve Buddhahood. Okay. So if your aspiration is, may I achieve, by this practice, may I achieve the Sambhogakaya, because it's a beautiful body, it's going to make me happy. You may, if you are lucky, you may achieve Pratika Buddhahood. And the other body is called the Dhammakaya. And that also is sometimes divided into two other kinds of bodies. One is called Swabhavakaya. Sometimes pronounced Sobhavakaya. That's the body, it's called the nature body. It is simply the ultimate nature of all the other bodies. So why is this called a body? Why is this categorized by itself? Well, you just have to chew on it, meditate on that. Okay. And the other one is the body of omniscience. And that one is still called the Dhammakaya. So once you become a Buddha, you will achieve these four bodies at the same moment. You will have a body very similar to the Sambhogakaya that you will practice with. And within that body, which is very similar to the Sambhogakaya, and at the very moment when you become a Buddha, that body transforms into the actual Sambhogakaya. And then you will have all the other bodies at the same time. The Dhammakaya, and then the Nimanakayas that you will have, and of course the nature body, which is the ultimate nature of all those bodies, all at the same time.
I'm a little confused about the Nimanakaya, because mm-hmm. I've read stories of Shakyamuni where he becomes sick. There's a story where something hits him in the heel and he bleeds, mm-hmm. and I've read that he had a personal physician. So is that the body that was getting sick, the permanent body, is that different from the Nimanakaya?
No, that is a Nimanakaya, but it's not the Sambhogakaya. There are two form bodies. There's one body that can appear as normal as other bodies. And it will appear to undergo the same conditions as other bodies. And that body is a true, just like the Buddha, one other way of calling it is called a mind body, a mind-made body. Like the Buddha thinks that, okay, this person needs to see this kind of form, and the Buddha creates this form for this person to see. And the form can appear to have the same qualities as the person whose body that the Buddha is appearing to. It appears to age, it appears to get sick. And that's why for the Buddha, there is the term appear to. Because the Buddha is not really actually experiencing that. Now, when you're on the path to achieve Buddhahood, after you make the determination, the diamond stone determination, I will achieve Buddhahood for the sake of sentient beings. And the reason that it's called a strong determination, the determination of a warrior, is because you have the reason that you're aspiring to it is not because of all the beautiful things that you're going to achieve. Okay. the reason that you aspire to it is specifically and only to end the suffering of all sentient beings. And in order for you to achieve that, you have to practicing the six perfections perfectly for about three countless eons. Okay? And that's the sutra path. And when your compassion, when your bodhicitta is so intense that it becomes like your hair is on fire, you just can't stand sentient beings suffering for any moment. And that kind of bodhicitta becomes so intense, then you can either sometime within the 3,000 countless eons enter the tantric path. If you from the start somehow you have the merit or the karma to enter the tantra path, or at the very last moment before you actually achieve Buddhahood, you have to enter the path of tantra. Okay. And that's when you usually hear the term Mahamudra. Okay. And the term Mahamudra within Tibetan Buddhism itself has different meanings among the different sects. Within the Gelugpa system, Mahamudra simply means meditation on emptiness. Okay. It's a term, mudra means seal. Or sometimes it refers to mudra like a hand gesture. And maha means great. And the Tibetan term for it is Chagya Chembo, or Chag Chen. You know, the Tibetans love to abbreviate things. Chagya Chembo or Chag Chen. Okay. And it's a very sexy term. I'm sure you've probably heard of it before, and the other traditions really make it sexy, because they have this whole tradition of a type of meditation that they call Mahamudra, and it's a kind of meditation where you're meditating on the nature of the mind. Okay. And the reason that it is very interesting and very appealing is because it seems easy to do. And some traditions of Mahamudra says you don't even need to be you don't need to have any initiations, any empowerments. You don't even need to be a Buddhist to be able to do Mahamudra. And it has this incredible ability to have this incredible results, where you're directly perceiving the true nature of reality, or the true nature of your mind. And also the term Mahamudra sometimes is referred to in Tantra, to refer to something completely different. Okay. Sometimes it refers to just the state of mind that is used to perceive emptiness in Tantra. Okay. Now, what does Mahamudra have to do with the three principal paths, the three principal teachings? Whether you're studying Mahamudra from a teacher who says that you don't need to be a Buddhist, whether you're studying Mahamudra from someone who is a Buddhist, to achieve the results of Mahamudra, the three principal paths must be done at the same time. It is a natural result of practicing the three principles that you actually end up with Mahamudra. Okay. So if Mahamudra is, as the Gelugpa says, it is merely the direct perception of emptiness, so Mahamudra becomes just the third path. And if Mahamudra is related with Tantra, which is a very powerful state of mind to directly perceive emptiness with, that has the effect of producing what will take eons to get result within the sutra path, just within a few moments of direct perception with the state of Mahamudra, you can achieve it also. That's why within Tantra, it is said that you can achieve Buddhahood within one lifetime. Okay. And the reason for getting into Tantra is not because you're thinking, oh, I don't think I can bear three countless eons, I don't have the time for that. And you just feeling lazy. Okay. You enter Tantra when you don't care how long it will take, but you just can't bear that sentient beings are suffering it for any moment of time. And that intense compassion makes you able to bear certain ascetic practices It also makes you able to bear, it also empowers you to be able to do, enact certain transformations that will take much longer in the sutra path. Okay. You still need the same kind of merit, the same amount of merit that someone in the sutra path is accumulating, that is taking the three countless eons to accumulate. Except instead of accumulating those merits within three countless eons, you're accumulating them within a much shorter period of time. I've answered most of the questions, believe it or not. And we have a very interesting little thing at the end there we're going to get into. So, as you are on the path, you know, flapping your two wings, the top and shit up, you're accumulating wisdom, and then you're also accumulating merit. Okay, tab and shit up. The activities that are included within the method or within the merit side, these are the causes that produces the form body. And then the practice that you do with the wisdom side, that's what eventually ends up with the Dhammakaya, with the mental body, with the omniscient form. Okay. Now that sort of tells you something, right? Does a listener Arhat have a Nimanakaya? No, they don't. And why don't they have Nimanakayas?
They wouldn't have a need for it. They wouldn't have a need for it. They don't have the desire to help other beings.
Yeah. And again, I have to say, the desire, not having the desire to help other sentient beings, should not be taken in a mundane way that we understand that term. Okay? It doesn't mean that they are consciously opposing the idea of helping sentient beings. Okay? If the Hinayana's tradition was a completely selfish tradition, it would have died as soon as the Buddha left. Right? They would have had no desire to teach the method to others, in which they are doing. And then they do practice the four immeasurables. Immeasurable compassion, immeasurable love, immeasurable joy. Okay. They do embrace all beings with compassion. Okay. So bodhicitta is something completely that is beyond the four immeasurables, completely beyond compassion. It's like taking compassion to an ultimate level. Okay. So because they do not have bodhicitta, so there's no need for them to have some sort of attribute which is mainly for the benefit of others, mainly for the interaction with others. And that's what the Nimanakaya is for. That's what the Sukhu is for. It is merely a means to interact with others. That's why the Buddhas have it. Buddhas don't have Sambhogakaya because, well, should I repeat? Because they wanted to be supermodels. Okay. It is mainly for the benefit of others. And one of the things that is said about it is that it remains for as long as samsara is remaining. For as long as samsara remains, that Sambhogakaya will remain. So that tells you, perhaps, when samsara is done with, there probably won't be any, Sambhogakayas. Maybe. Okay. If that's upsetting to you, you will lose that supermodel body that you worked so hard for. That goes back to that what I was talking about yesterday. What is your instinctual impulse? That's what truly determines which scope you're in. Okay. If you're aspiring to achieve the Sambhogakaya just because you want to have a nice body so people can appreciate you, you're not even of the first scope yet. You're just wanting things of this life. And you could be doing tantra, you could be doing the highest kind of initiations, and all you have in your mind are because you want to achieve a body that people will appreciate. People can say, oh, you have a nice body, and you can say in the mirror and say, oh yeah, you're right. Okay. If that's really the instinctual impulse, then you're not even a Buddhist. Okay. Because your aspiration is still stuck with this life. You're still delusional. So, renunciation and bodhicitta falls under the method aspect, accumulating merit, And these things, by having renunciation, and by having bodhicitta, and by acting under those influence, that eventually leads to having one day Nimanakaya. Okay. And then by constantly having your mind directly perceive emptiness, that one day leads to the, that's a trick thing I'm gonna say, that leads to the Dhammakaya. So do Hinayana Arhats, do they have Dhammakayas?
Not omniscient.
They're not omniscient. Yeah. So if you have, if you define Dhammakaya, sometimes it is said that Dhammakaya is simply refers to the direct perception of emptiness, that moment. And sometimes you might even hear it in other schools, they use that term to mean the true nature of your mind. Okay. But if you attach the quality of omniscience to the Dhammakaya, then directly perceiving emptiness constantly is not the only cause for it. Okay. Bodhicitta is the main cause that leads to omniscience. It's the special quality that makes that practice of making your mind see emptiness all the time. That's what makes that activity turn into omniscience later on. You won't believe this, but I think I've covered everything. Mahamudra. I guess this is making up for yesterday. Okay. Now this very last point, this very last question, sort of brings us to the things that we discussed yesterday a little bit, that we spent a lot of time on. Me tsewe terchen chenurezik, right? And that means me tsewe terchen. The one with me tsewe is it refers to bodhicitta actually. Okay, me tsewe terchen chenurezik, the treasury of bodhicitta, and that's chenurezik, Avalokiteshvara. Okay. That refers to Manjushri. Dupu Malu Tsonze Sanwedak. Sanwedak means the owner of the secrets. And the reason that Vajrapani is called the owner of the secrets is because Vajrapani is the one who made a lot of requests for the tantras. He's the one who asked the Buddha to teach the tantras. Many of the tantras. And that's why a lot of the tantras are called, referred to such and such and such requested by Vajrapani. Such and such and such requested by Vajrapani.
Okay. Are there tantras in Mahayana and Theravada?
In Theravada, there's no such thing as a tantra. But in Theravada, there are certain practices that are very similar to practices which are in tantra. But they don't call it tantra. They refuse to call it tantra. What was that? A couple of days ago, I was reading a newspaper while I was in, when I was out there. It was about, it was a case, they're looking for someone. A husband who killed his wife in the most gruesome way. Because he thought that, well, he was convinced that his wife was the devil. And it was his wife that was causing him to make his business go bad. So he was helped to kill the wife, chop the body, and then burn it or something like that. I'm not sure, but get rid of it or something like that, in some ritualistic way. And the person who told him to do that, that person is called a tantrika. And that's what the newspaper said. A tantrika convinced this guy that his wife was a devil and he has to get rid of her, and then he told him this ritual of a rich killing ritual of getting rid of the wife so his business can prosper. And when I saw tantrika next to it, I said, whoa, we are still fighting that. Tantra has still has a very bad name, especially in the land that gave birth to it. In the newspaper now, Now, imagine you now going to that same area or to that same culture and say, "Oh, I practice tantra." They probably arrest you. Okay. So be careful. Okay. If you're practicing tantra, you're not even supposed to let people know that you're doing that. Okay, it's supposed to be secret. Okay, and that's evidently one of the reasons why. You get arrested, maybe. You get beaten up, worse. So this guy, along with his guru, on the run. And I'm asking myself, I wonder how is his business doing? Yeah. So, let's go to, Vajrapani, who's the owner of the tantras. So Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, and Vajrapani are said to have emanated as one being called Jesankapa. But mainly he's called the emanation of Manjushri. Mainly the emanation of Manjushri. And I told you what Gyume Kenso Rinpoche, how he explained it. How is it that he could be the emanation of all those three? Right? Now, to confuse the story even more, Jesongaba, in his career, I think it was Lama Umapa, one of his teachers, Jesongaba wrote this, the three verses, "You are Manjushri, you are Avalokiteshvara." He wrote it in praise of Lama Umapa. And Lama Umapa, seeing that Jesongaba is such an extraordinary being, he reversed it. Instead, he gave it to Jesongaba. He said, "No, you are Avalokiteshvara, you are Manjushri, you are..." Lama Umapa had a very interesting relationship with Jesongaba. Lama Umapa was like Jesongaba's, should I use that term? Like oracle. Lama Umapa had this incredible ability of directly communicating with Manjushri. And when Jesongaba had questions for Manjushri, he would go to Lama Umapa. He said, "Oh, can you call Manjushri for me? I have some questions for him." And Lama Umapa would, do whatever he does. And he would have Manjushri communicate with Jesongaba. And Jesongaba would question Manjushri directly that way. And it is said that Jesongaba asked Manjushri advice about everything that he did. Even if he's going to go somewhere, he would even ask Manjushri's advice: who should he take, when should he go, what time should he, when should he arrive there, when should he come back. Every detail of what he would do, he would ask Manjushri for advice.
How happened the communication concretely?
How often?
No, how? He sees him appearing, or he closes his eyes, he sees?
Well, in the beginning, it was Lama Umapa would see Manjushri, and Lama Umapa would speak. Mm-hmm. He said, "Oh, this is what Manjushri said." And Jesongaba wouldn't see anyone. And later on, after doing more extensive practice, Jesongaba began to see Manjushri himself directly. He didn't need Lama Umapa any longer to communicate with Manjushri. But probably asking yourself, "Wait a minute, is any Manjushri? Why is he calling Manjushri to ask Manjushri questions?" So the term emanation, we have to understand it in a different way. Okay. Exactly how we are supposed to understand it, I don't quite know yet. There are many explanations. The one explanation is the one that I told you, Gyume Kenso Rinpoche told me. And another explanation, which seems something that sometimes His Holiness points to. Like, for example, His Holiness refers to himself as the one who has the merit to be called His Holiness. He never directly says that I was the 13th Dalai Lama, who is now the 14th. He said, "I'm the one who has the merit, the karma, to be called the 14th. And sometimes he even says, "Well, I don't know who's going to be the 15th. And he sometimes points to someone and says, maybe you will be the 15th. And that's sort of confusing for people. We're talking about, how am I going to be the next you? So the explanation that goes along with what Zolinus is sometimes alluding to is that an emanation could be someone who is inspired. It is somewhat connected with what Yume Kensuri Rinpoche explained, right? Like, there is the blessing that is called the blessing of Manjushri that is perpetually being given out. And of course, there's the blessings of all the enlightened beings that are perpetually being, the waves of blessings are continually going out. Right? And then you or someone is very connected, feels a very close connection with Manjushri. Okay. Or feel a very close connection with whoever, Avalokiteshvara, Vajrapani, or whoever, okay? And because of that close connection, and because of aspirations and prayers that you make to be close to Manjushri or Avalokiteshvara, you sort of like catch on one of those waves as you go through the process of rebirth. And when you catch on one of those waves, so to speak, you sort of take on the quality of Avalokiteshvara or Manjushri. And when those who have eyes can see, they sort of see that quality in you. So they say, oh, you are an emanation of Manjushri. Okay. That's why, maybe this might explain why someone can be, have to be told, oh, by the way, you're omniscient and you're Manjushri. Oh, wait, really? Okay. And maybe also that's why they can be different emanations of the same being, okay? That might explain it. And of course, there's the direct explanation, which is, you know, Manjushri himself decided to become this particular personality at this particular place, and then he, I don't know, whatever he does, okay? And then there's this appearance of this person who appears to be born, and who is Manjushri. The Kamapa, for example, the 17th Kamapa. And also, His Holiness talks about this. When these tulkus, as they're called in Tibetan, these tulkus, these emanations, when they're born, and when they start to speak, the memory is very fresh in their minds. And some of them actually are able to recall those things, or able to speak and say, this is such a fact, I am such and such a person. Or the memory may be so, they may have such influence on their minds that they are able to recall things that they don't really know why they're recalling certain things. And someone may present them with something and for some reason that they know it. Okay. But as they become accustomed to the new birth, you know, having to go to the process of acclimation, and they have to relearn speech. We have to relearn walking, and this is a major thing for a baby, you know. Okay, so it becomes a major undertaking. So the memory slowly goes in the unconsciousness, and they slowly forget. This explanation came from the 17th Kamapa. He said, as I grew older, my memory that I remember that I used to have, I don't have it anymore as a child. The memory of, you know, those incredible things that the people are talking about. And later on, because of practice, the memory is triggered again, and they're able to remember, and they're able to know definitely, oh yeah, I was the 16th. This is what I did. And of course, they will not go about and saying, I know I was the 16th. They probably will say that to some very selected disciple, or disciples, and only after they pass, after they left their body, will that disciple reveal, oh, this is what he said on such occasion. Okay. So there are these kinds of explanations for emanations. Okay. So Manjushri is said to have been Jesongkhapa is said to have been an emanation of Manjushri. And because of that, that is given as a reason why the words of Jesongkhapa is trustworthy. Because he had direct communication with Manjushri. Everything he did, he consulted Manjushri. For some people, that's acceptable, but I'm not saying that it's just, you know, how do I verify this, okay? If someone tells me that, oh, so-and-so, what so-and-so said is correct because so-and-so is in correct connection with some being that I cannot see. For me, from my low state, it's not convincing. Okay. And it's unfortunate also, I think, Milarepa said something very beautiful to one of his disciples. One of his disciples was praising him because he saw Milarepa doing these incredible things. He said, "Ah, this is proof that you are a Buddha. This is proof that you are a Buddha. That you are appearing here as a ordinary person. Because no ordinary person could have ever achieved what you've achieved." And Milarepa answered, said, "It is great that you have such devotion, such faith in your guru as being a Buddha, but it's also a shame that you believe that only Buddhas can do these things." So I'm sort of like, I'm not saying I don't admire Desongkhapa, but if you tell me that he's Manjushri, that's what he was did all these times, I say, well, I mean, what's the big deal? He's already omniscient, so it's not a big deal for him to do these things that he did, right? But if you tell me that Kenimboche was a goof off and his career was going to be just a mere secretary, and then he turned his life around, he excelled, became the number one Larampa, I said, that's something that I can admire. I'm saying I don't admire Desongkhapa. I mean, I prostrate to him. But telling me his life story and what he did and because he did, because he's Manjushri, doesn't inspire me. It depresses me. Mm-hmm. Not depresses me in the same, but it makes me say, oh, I have to be a Manjushri to be able to do that. I'm not Manjushri, I guess, I better forget it. But when Kenimboche was a goof off, what the French are famous for doing. And the Americans also inherited that, especially when you're young.
Clowning.
No. Not that. Something that you all did when you were young, still are doing probably, with authority.
Rebellion.
Yeah. I mean, Kenimboche was a rebel. If you were authority, he made sure that he put you to shame in some way. Of course, he got beaten for it once in a while. But he was a major goof-off who became a Larampa Geshe, first class. You have any idea what that means? That means he was such an excellent scholar that at the age of 81, he was able to do what fresh Larampa Geshes couldn't do. When he revisited Serra, and he was received as a god, okay, because of the many things that he did for Serra. One of the things that he did for Serra was to clean up the administration, because it was such chaos before Rinpoche got to Serra. I mean, Serra in the south. While they were trying to rebuild themselves, there was monks are independent. There's no way of telling them what to do, so they were doing whatever they wanted to do. So there was really no central organization. And Kenimboche, being who he was, he made sure that people did what he told them to do, and they did. They obeyed him. So not only that, and one of the things that even nowadays, Gyumi Kenso Rinpoche, a lot of great teachers nowadays cry when they hear Kenimboche's name, because they were direct benefactors of Kenimboche's kindness. And because of Kenimboche, they say that they are alive. Okay. And some of them even remember that Kenimboche had sort of instituted this thing of rewarding scholars. Like, if you did well, you would get 25 rupees for the month. I mean, I don't know back then what you could do with it, but I guess you can buy yourself a can of soda or something. And if you did better, and then you would increase that. And that inspired a lot of people who were starving to engage in a very rigorous curriculum. So here's this being who was a goof-off, who's now a god at Sarah, who was able to, at the age of 81, sat on the throne of Sarah, and then quoting things that he learned when he was eight. A lot of geshes, what they say is after 5 years has gone by, is that I forgot everything that I memorized. And here he is, 81 years old. Didn't you hear me say? 81 years old. Reciting what he memorized when he was 8 years old. To become Laramba Geshe, the five texts, you have to memorize the root texts. Not only do you have to memorize the root texts, you have to memorize the major commentaries to them. All these things remain fresh in his mind. And I think towards later, well, never mind. Anyway, so it's when I hear that this was a goof-off, and I say, ah, now that inspires me. That makes me want to practice. Because it makes me feel that I can do it too. So why was Jason Gaba able to do what he was able to do? Well, he was Manjushri, and he saw Manjushri directly. Well, why? That's why he was able to do that. Huh. Wow.
When you spoke about Nirvana, You said, when we gain Nirvana, it doesn't prevent us from changing.
Does it prevent you from changing?
Yeah, we can still be changing beings.
The state of Nirvana itself doesn't change in the sense of it becomes something non-Nirvana. Yeah. But the being who is experiencing Nirvana is constantly going, changing. It's constantly changing.
Okay.
In that sense, yeah.
But you said Nirvana can never be lost.
Can never be lost.
So it means in our mainstream, our billions of past lives, we never, ever reached Nirvana before.
Never.
Okay.
There's no such thing as someone who fell from Nirvana. It's impossible. If you achieve a state that was extremely blissful, and it lasted for, I don't know, a few eons, and you lost it, it wasn't Nirvana.
What do you mean by eons?
Eons? Very, 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 very long periods of time.
Are you speaking with the span of one lifetime?
No, not one lifetime.
No.
Many lifetimes. Sometimes, I guess an age, you can call it that. An age, you can call it the age of civilizations, where one civilization goes up and goes down, that's one age. And it could be, an age could be one planet comes and many things goes through, it goes through many different changes, beings appear, beings disappear, the planet disappears. That can also be called an age, an eon. Okay. It's not a fixed, it doesn't have a fixed number in Buddhism. But in Hinduism, I think it's fixed. Like to 400 million something like that. I don't remember. Any other questions?
So, Shirak, wisdom, right? With wisdom, you overcome the mental affliction obstacles, and with merit, you overcome the obstacles to omissions,
yeah.
Right? And yet, it's merit that produces the form body and wisdom that produces the wisdom body. In other words, there's like a reversal or something. Because if it's wisdom, if it's merit that produces, that gets rid of the obstacles to omniscience, or wisdom, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet it's, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I never noticed that before.
Yeah. You talk about Nyendrip and Shedrip.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Nyendrip, the main thing, I mean, Nyendi, the reason that you have obstacles, what you call mental affliction obstacles, is because of ignorance. And the direct antidote for that, of course, is wisdom.
Right.
And Shiji, which is somewhat connected with, I guess, wisdom, like the wisdom of the Buddha, is the wisdom of the Buddha is in the, I guess, in that category. That is, Shijip is blocking you from achieving the wisdom of the Buddha.
Right.
And Nyendrip is blocking you from merely achieving liberation from samsara.
But then the wisdom of a Buddha is really bodhicitta.
Yeah. Very good.
Could you please go a little more into a little more detail regarding the meditation, the renunciation meditation? I was supposed to go in there thinking about the root text of the three paths, or just trying to be in a stable mood.
You're talking about the meditations in the homework?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's look at one of them. This is asking you to do analytical meditation. Analytical meditation is one of those things that Jason Kappa emphasized on. Of its importance. Analytical meditation is a kind of meditation where you're trying to reach a conclusion through going through various reasons. And so doing an analytical meditation on renunciation is that you're trying to reach the conclusion, or trying to reach it's not going to be quite realization yet, but very close to that, the realization where you have renunciation. And what you do is you go through various forms of reasoning. And the reasons can be, you heard someone that you trust said such and such, and you analyze what they say, and you come up with your own conclusion and say, "Ah," and then renunciation is invoked within your mind, within your being. But it's basically proving to yourself something and using reasoning to get to a conclusion. That's what the analytical meditation is. So when you sit down and doing this meditation, you're basically, you know, thinking and reasoning. And the way to get to renunciation is to simply look at life. Look at it. We look at it with unbiasedness. Okay. If you really look at life, if you really see it, you will develop renunciation. Okay. Now, renunciation doesn't mean giving up pleasure, in the sense of now I no longer want pleasure, now I'm gonna stay, you're gonna do the opposite, you're gonna, you know, stick with pain. Okay. The reason that you have renunciation is because you see that certain avenues cannot give pleasure, and you renounce those avenues. Not the goal, not the pleasure, not the pleasant experiences that you actually walk those paths. That's not what you're renouncing. What you're renouncing is the delusion that these particular paths, these particular actions, can lead to a lasting pleasant experience. Okay. It's not that you, again, it's not that you give up on ice cream, but you give up on the idea or the delusion that ice cream leads to a lasting happiness. Okay. So you would meditate looking at things, and looking at it, what you call looking at it with bare awareness, without you having any prejudgments of good or bad, and even without having any, for example, don't even enter the meditation thinking that, okay, desire is bad, let me do meditation so I can get rid of it. So you do a meditation, discover that desire is bad. And when it's a discovery that it is bad, you will naturally want to get rid of it. And you enter the meditation expecting to come out that maybe desire is good. Okay.
So we were talking earlier about how when you eat an ice cream, the pleasure isn't coming from the ice cream.
Uh-huh.
So where is it coming from? Is it coming from mind, or is it coming from karma?
So where is it coming from? So you have me, ice cream, interact, and then pleasant experience. So those three elements, me, ice cream, interact. So does it come from ice cream? So we already eliminated that, right? It doesn't come from ice cream. So what's left? Me and interaction. So is interaction what leads to the pleasure? It can't be, because as you continue to interact with the ice cream, the pleasure that is not there anymore. So interacting is not the what causes the pleasure. So what's left? I guess that's it. And then you, and if you want to be more sophisticated, you break down me to see exactly what part of me, where is it coming from? Is it my mouth that producing the pleasure?
But we experience it as pleasurable because of our past karma is conditioned us to experience that.
Yeah. And eventually, you have to come to that as a conclusion. Not because you read it in the book, because you have to. That's the only conclusion you can come up with. Because sometimes you eat the ice cream, it's pleasurable. Sometimes you eat the ice cream, it's not pleasurable. Okay, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to let you go on time. That you just have to, just get into the book to discover. I guess tell you, if you haven't started reading the book yet, start reading it. And it's not an order, we are independent beings. You have the right to suffer if you want.